It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
This time, the National Space Administration requires all aliens to register. Forms are available at your local post office. Those without forms must appear, however briefly, at the Bureau's astral offices on Nooker Street. Aliens, register now.
WBAI, New York. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to fantasy, science fiction, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, a review, a short story, and a remembrance of two people. Stay tuned. Oh, and no Facebook Live. I left my tripod at home.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There is a moment in Justice League, which is now out on home video and on demand, when a Russian family living in the shadow of a shuttered nuclear reactor, more on that later, has their home besieged by a swarm of Mothmen. During this, there's a shot where a young girl reaches up and pulls down a can of bug spray from a shelf. And it was a full 30 seconds before I realized, oh, that's a joke. Now, I don't particularly consider myself the most acute of intellects, but I think I'm pretty good at picking out humorous moments when they present themselves. So the fact that I was debating whether or not I should have been laughing at that moment can only mean that director Zack Snyder is once again working at the top of his form, taking something that should be fun and exciting and sapping all the life out of it until what's left is a mass of computer-generated bombast glazed with shades of inky black. It's always been clear that DC has been trying to model their most recent films in the format of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, with everything leading up to Justice League being DC's Avengers. Turns out the replication is so blatant that it's kind of embarrassing. Joss Whedon contributed to the script, and his facility with wit and character show up here and there, but not enough. The villain, Steppenwolf, voiced by Charon Hines, and computer-generated on the screen, sports Loki-like horns, seeks a trio of magical widgets that will permit him world conquest like Loki, and is accompanied by that swarming phalanx of Mothmen, who are not unlike the Chitauri. Of course, the finale has to see the Justice League teaming up to kick Mothman Tookus, although since the throwdown is set in that abandoned nuclear facility rather than a teeming Manhattan, the battle loses a certain resonance. That one besieged family has to substitute, along with the admittedly amusing sight of Superman airlifting an entire apartment building out of harm's way. The irony is that while the Avengers movies function as culmination, all the individual Marvel movies preceding them leading up to the explosive action of an Avengers team-up, Justice League struggles to level the DC universe up to some kind of franchise baseline, a kind of reassurance that things are getting back to normal. Superman, played by Henry Cavill, and whose digitally airbrushed upper lip didn't bother me quite as much as it did everybody else, doesn't kill anybody. Batman, as portrayed by Ben Affleck, has a bit more spring in his step than he did in Batman v Superman and is teamed up, the brave and the bold style, with a youthful, novice Flash played by Ezra Miller, who is unabashedly styled as Peter Parker to Bruce Wayne's Tony Stark. And I kind of liked Jason Momoa's burly, confident spin to Aquaman, very Chris Hemsworth-like. Okay, I gotta stop this. Let me just note that Gal Gadot is Wonder Woman again, and I don't think she's used quite as well as she could be. I'm looking forward to her getting back to her own films. And Ray Fisher is Cyborg, and that's it. He's Cyborg. He's fine. Thing is, for all that Snyder seems to be conceding that the DC universe is better served when it isn't awash in objectivism, he's still Zack Snyder. And for all the action and spectacle and quips, a certain stolidness accompanies his efforts. On paper, Justice League promises a serviceable superhero exercise. Not more than that, but that could have been enough. In execution, though, the film still disappoints. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
And thank you, Dan. Okay, well, first of all, I brought my phone, I brought, you know, which has its camera in it, and I brought various things so that I would be able to do a Facebook Live, which I haven't been able to do in a little while. Actually, I did one this weekend at a science fiction convention, Heliosphere, which you'll be hearing, by the way, next week. I did two interviews with guests of honor, and that's what's going to be on our show next week. Will be Charles E. Gannon and Eric Flint, each of them fascinating and wonderful people who also collaborate in fiction. But who also have very much major careers on their own. At any rate, so I've been doing Facebook Live very happily and very with a great deal of enthusiasm pretty much since the beginning of this year. And if you want to see any of them, you can go to my timeline on Facebook, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, and you can watch some of the shows as I do them. But as I mentioned a few weeks ago that I was going to do a show and not do Facebook Live, a regular listener wrote me on Facebook and said, good, that you're not doing it because too much Facebook Live, I wasn't necessarily focusing on the radio aspect of the show. And I thought about that, and there's some truth. Now, the thing about doing the Facebook Live is that not only does it let you see me doing the show, but more importantly, you get to chat to me and to each other, and I can take a look at it and say, oh, well, such and such is asking this question, and I'll respond. And also people will chat with each other. But various things began to happen, and this is why I believe this listener made that comment, which I think has a good point, and it's that it was another distraction. Now, the very cool thing is not only do people get to type in and comment, but when I get home, I can look at all the comments, those that I didn't have time to during the show itself, and I can respond then, and people respond back. And there's maybe, oh, up to 10 people watching the show live at once. It's, after all, 1:10 in the morning in New York, and later on, you know, before the show is over, it's 2:45. Not that many people in New York following the Facebook Live, although it's nice to know that I have a couple of people from abroad, one fellow from Wales, another one from Bangkok, and so forth. He's going to be here in April. It's Somtao Sucharitkul. And the conversation can go on for weeks. And so, to me, this is like a new medium. I was pretty much active in the earliest days of online activity with BBSs and stuff like that. I was online as early as, say, late 1980 and then onward. The internet was not a major thing at that point. And there were various online services, but I'm not going to go into all of that history. But it's relevant to the point that Facebook is now the face of the home for so many people. If Google is the one supplying all the services and sucking all the information out of you as you do it so that they can monetize that information, Facebook is the place that's doing the same thing and trying to provide your home. And, well, I have strong feelings about the differences between various services and what's good and what's evil. And if we do get into that, it'll be later on in the show, not so much now. But the idea that I could be actually having that conversation several weeks after the show, and people could be discovering the show anew. They could watch it. You can watch my show from 3 months ago right now. Well, after this is over. And then, when that is all done, you can type in a comment and other viewers or I will type back. And so it goes on. So that's really a new medium. That's really a new way of looking at how we use radio and how we're using online services. And, you know, radio's not going away, people. Even if it retreats from broadcast antenna, podcasts still exist. There are all kinds of podcasts. The spoken word continues very much so. These mics don't listen to that. Okay. They're not, okay. It's in this rubber thing. It's supposed to keep it still. Right. And when you touch it, it's not supposed to make any noise. But given let's just say the various things here at WBAI ain't working. Anyway. So Facebook Live, I think, is a lot of fun. You know, it's, it gives me sort of an ego boost to watch the people as they're logging in and talk to them and they're talking to me. But I got the point that this person has. But I don't necessarily want to give it up. But by the same token, I get it. So when I resume with Facebook Live, which probably won't be for a few weeks, because next week I'm planning on pre-recording the show, and because I've got a gig happening earlier that evening and I can't really do both. And then the week after that, it's just too close to Passover when I am cooking not one but two seders that I've got to focus on that. So I'm going to ask, I have asked somebody to fill in for me, and hopefully he will manage to do that. And if not him, somebody else. I have a woman in mind who might be very good for that. But anyway, they won't be doing Facebook Lives, if that's a term I can try to coin. So what I'm going to do the next few times that I try doing that is I'm not going to look at the camera. I am not going to watch. I am not going to react to the camera whenever I am on the air like I am now. On the other hand, if I'm playing a recording, if I'm playing music, whatever it may be, then I can engage with people and talk with them and at them as much as possible. And we'll find another way for people who are listening online to communicate with me. There's also too much of a disparity between what comes through Facebook and what broadcasts over the air. It turns out that for the most part, and this is very bizarre, that for the most part, the broadcast hits Facebook before it reaches the Empire State Building and is broadcast to all you good folk. So that also says something about the state of our technologies here. So maybe we'll do something like, if people want to ask a question, they can send me an email, they can use Twitter or something like that. But during the show, while I'm talking live on the air, I'm not going to react to Facebook. It does take away from the beauty that is freeform radio. Because I am sitting here, I've got two computers in front of me to deal with, one sound mixing board, our telephone system, and various things. And everything that I play on the air has to come through those computers, or it doesn't get on the air. We have no turntables we have two CD players, but I don't trust them, and for good reason. So, I've been stretching myself a little too far. To add to that, this other technology, which I've got to say, the interface is not a simple one and not a great one. So I'm also interested in your opinion about the Facebook Live. Enough people have watched it. There was one show that I did on Facebook Live that by the time so many people had seen it, it had over 4,000 hits. And still growing. So I know there are people out there who have watched them. So I would like your opinion on what to do. Should I figure out a better way to incorporate Facebook Live and be totally interactive with people? Should I ignore it altogether? Which I don't want to do. I like the idea of using multimedia. Or should I do this combo thing? At least try it out. That simply, when I'm on the air, I'll stare at the computer and stare at my controls and not look at the phone, or at least at what people are typing on it, and respond to people and talk to people during the show only when I'm not actively on the air trying to talk. I'd like your opinions or ideas, and you can send me those opinions or ideas by emailing me at jim@ourwolf.com. That Jim is J-I-M, and Our Wolf is HOURWOLF.com. So I'm very much looking forward to some feedback. Or just say hi. Okay, yeah, I'm just realizing that if somebody even taps this table, the springs resonate on the air. They really oughtn't to be doing that. The whole point of this mount. See, if you're on Facebook, I could show it to you right now. The whole point of this mount is to protect the microphone from noise that a person might be making while sitting at a table. But here I'm just lightly tapping my fingers. It's fun. Let's get to the content of today's show, which is sparked by unfortunate events. We lost two people this week, one directly affiliated with science fiction and one not so much. And the first one, who was one of the great forces in science fiction, but may not be as well known to many of you out there, is Kate Wilhelm. And Kate, I never met her. Somebody suggested that I broadcast something of her tonight, but I never actually met her. She's never lived in New York. She rarely came to New York. But when she died on March 8th, so 5 days ago, when she died, at first there were just, you know, great outpouring of people going, oh God, you know, how sad. And then the LA Times published an appreciation. Boing Boing was there. And she and her husband, Damon Knight. Damon is probably better remembered because he wrote more short stories that resonated with mass culture. And if I'll just say three words, and those of you of a certain age will get it immediately. It's a cookbook! That was Damon Knight. He was so much more than that. But Damon and Kate together were founders of the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop, which has done so much for so many people. They were both, and Kate alone was simply a great writer. She wrote a series of mysteries, the Barbara Holloway mysteries. She wrote other mysteries, Constance Lytle and Charlie, I was never sure how to pronounce, Michael John, I guess, M-E-I-K-L-E-J-O-H-N, Michael John. And a whole bunch of standalone mysteries. She wrote nonfiction about telling stories. She edited any number of anthologies. And I don't know how many novels and collect. Actually, I do know how many novels and collections. I can look at Wikipedia. I should probably go to ISFDB, but I'm already on Wikipedia. And Well, let's say 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, about 40 books there alone. And that's just in science fiction fantasy, plus another 30 or so mystery novels. And most importantly, she was good. And she was a very influential, very important person. When Margot Adler attended the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop, although the other teachers included Ursula K. Le Guin and Joanna Russ and Harlan Ellison and Samuel R. Delaney and, you know, one great, great writer and person after another, after another, after another. The final week were Kate and Damon, and that was the most special week for most people. What they do now is, I believe it's usually the final week of the workshop. It's a 6-week workshop, I should mention. The final week of that workshop is usually an editor to help. I'm just looking at various news here to see who's got it. The main place would seem to be published just yesterday. It was the LA Times, Scott Bradfield. And well, go to Google, go to news, type in Kate Wilhelm, W-I-L-H-E-L-M, and look for the obit in the LA Times. Or, even better, the one from Boing Boing. Let's see who wrote that one. Now, this isn't me getting confused by other things. It's just my usual typical confusion. Yeah, they point out that perhaps her best-known book was Where Late the Sweet Bird Sang. Can somebody put an ad blocker on this darned browser? Okay. Gordon Van Gelder, who we worked with only a month ago, wrote a appreciation of Kate's life and accomplishments. But that is mostly print. And what he wrote in there, including here, they excerpted it, and so shall I. There is also extraordinary intelligence at work in her fiction. One of Kate's mystery novels hinges on the use of the, quote, morning after, end quote, abortion drug, RU486. Half a decade later, I was in an editorial meeting in which a mystery using the same plot element was being touted as the next big commercial thing, and I realized once again how often Kate grasps a new concept, turns it over and around, and holds its flaws up to light before most people have even recognized it for what it is. Small wonder her stories seem to be ahead of their time so frequently. 25 years before Survivor hit TV screens, she practically predicted it in Ladies and Gentlemen, This Is Your Crisis. Yeah, Robert Sheckley, whose daughter we just worked with, Elisa Quitney, Sheckley did the same thing with one of my favorite stories, The Prize of Peril, which was pretty much sums up today's reality show trend in so many ways, and that story got ripped off by more than one writer, and to the point where there was a movie where Sheckley never got credited. And you can, if you're familiar with the story, you know which movie it was. That was one loss. The other loss came really 2 days ago. And this one is, of course, much more known to the world, Stephen Hawking. And there's not much that I can say about him because he was a great influence. I have read him. I, of course, never met him. I shouldn't say of course, but no, I never met him. But I wrote I read his best known book about, and of course now the title escapes me, so I'm going to have to rely. Now that is one of the very cool things on the internet. You know, they can just look up the title very quickly. A Brief History of Time. Thank you. Okay. And he really is up there with the great scientists like Albert Einstein and, you know, I would say of the 20th century and, of course, into the 21st century, there are other people who did a great deal to popularize science, and that would include Carl Sagan and more recently Neil deGrasse Tyson and so forth. But of active space scientists and cosmologists, not so much. Hawking was a unique, I do not think, you know, a lot of other people that helped popularize, including, say, Brian Cox, our own Michio Kaku. These are great people who do more to popularize science than they spend time theorizing it and breaking it down. Although Michio did a pretty damned good job, I must say, in Hypercube. I haven't read all of his books, but that one was great. After that, I think he became more of a populist and a presenter, which, of course, reaches that many more people. But his Hypercube book helped more science fiction writers than you can shake a stick at. And you can shake a stick, and probably should, at a lot of science fiction writers. So it is to today's program that we are going to dedicate to the great Stephen Hawking. And I'm going to say something maybe a little later that will probably upset a great many people. I'll say it now, and I'll back it up later, being not a great scientist of myself, but here it is. In brief, Stephen Hawking's main goal in writing was to help people understand the very beginning of the universe. The Big Bang. I don't buy it. From my limited understanding, which is a step back, and sometimes a step back from deep, deep understanding is a legitimate thing, there are so many legitimate scientists who believed in an alternate theory, the solid-state theory of the universe, which then went on to predict things like the multiverse and things like that, that the Big Bang had to retrofit things into. As a matter of fact, one of the main people, a respected science fiction writer, a respected scientist, a fine science fiction writer, mathematician, and musician, Fred Hoyle, was a great proponent of this. And what they did was, as people accepted the idea of this expanding universe thing, where there was a kernel that then burst out all of a sudden, he basically said, what? You think that the universe began with some kind of a Big Bang? That's how the term got coined. It was a put-down. And many, many scientists did not accept it. And what happens with a lot of scientific theory is that people say, okay, let's retrofit as much stuff as we can. And as long as it doesn't break the model that we have in mind, we can say that's real. So for years and years and years, we were taught that volcanoes killed the dinosaurs. Now it's a meteor. And I spoke to a person when I worked at a major science museum. Not that I was a scientist. I was, in fact, their IT director and network administrator. And then I hired an IT director over me who eventually fired me. The I got to ask this scientist who was a paleontologist. So this thing, it was relatively new at the time. So that makes it about 15, 20 years ago. So it's absolute, this is it, that a meteor killed all the dinosaurs? He said, yep. No question about it. He was, in fact, a little abrupt and rude. Something that also helped me feel one way or the other about it. And remember, I was this guy's IT director. So, you know, don't brush me off. I know your password. At any rate, now that's being called into question. Or rather, there's additional information that it wasn't just a meteor that struck here. It was also that and these other conditions that created a perfect storm, so that if there was this event occurred and then about 100 years later, which is just a blink of the eye in geological terms, something else happened, that these formed what we might call a perfect storm of events that caused the extinction event that killed off dinosaurs and other species. A lot of species survived. If it was, in fact, a meteor, you see, they haven't yet retrofit that into that particular canard. The same thing is true of the Big Bang. Dark matter. How does that fit in? It's, if you'll pardon the expression, a hole in the Big Bang theory. At any rate, I'm probably wrong. I am not a cosmologist. I'm not even a high school graduate, people. But as I do a lot of science reading, and I do, more than the average bear, I do my share of science reading, starting, by popular writers, including Stephen Hawking, but also Bill Bryson, and so many other wonderful writers, and Michio Kaku, that have brought theory and thinking into this world. The Big Bang Theory just hasn't convinced me. And as I read every so often, there are a few mavericks out there who didn't fully buy the Big Bang Theory. One of them, before the Big Bang Theory existed, the idea of the expanding universe and all that, one person who said there were multiple explanations for why things seem to be flying apart from each other was Einstein. He did not fully buy into the quantum physics as we know it now. He had a lot of problems with it. And the faster in light travel, he said you couldn't go faster than light. And other people said, there, you see, I've proved you can. Well, and then 10 years later, they go, why do you know? He was right after all. The Big Bang Theory, folks, has never been proven. And people will go, ha! That proves how illiterate you are. That proves that you're scientifically a bozo, like many, many things that you hear in many, many places, including, I dare say, certain things that you will hear on this radio station. And I'm not that this is a conspiracy theory or anything. This is simply a great theory that explains a lot, that is worth all of the pursuit, but is not the final word in science. And yes, I'm a strong, strong believer in replicatable science. But please remember, when you look at those amazing photographs taken by the Hubble telescope, taken on Mars, this and that and the other thing, you know those incredible colors that you see? They are added after the fact. They do not transmit colors from those distances. We use spectroscopes by which we detect temperatures. And radio transmission, which is what all light and all these things are. And we can assign colors to them. And it's no doubt accurate. I believe that. But the point is that so much of it comes from human imposition of thought. And, well, I think the person who had it best was the one who said, "There's more in heaven and earth than is dreamt of in your philosophy." And I think he said Horatio after that, but I'm not sure of the exact quote. But anyhow, you knows who I mean. So, one way or the other, do read A Brief History of Time. Do embrace it. Do study the Big Bang. Embrace that. Just the exercise, the thought experiment of doing that is great and brilliant. And we're not going to get a better explanation in our lifetimes. All I'm doing is saying it's not necessarily the final word. There are other theories. I mean, how many planets? When I grew up, we had 9 planets. And then along come a few people who say, "Nah, we don't have 9 planets. We either have 8 or we have thousands." And now, by the way, they're leaning towards the thousands in the redefinition. A lot of people are unhappy as to, well, all I know is that by taking away one planet, you harmed one of my favorite all-time songs by Christine Lavin. It's called Planet X. She did a later version, but I like the original.
In Arizona at the turn of the century, astro-mathematician Percival Lowell was searching for what he called Planet X, 'cause he knew deep down in his soul that an unseen gravitational presence meant a new planet spinning in the air, joining the other 8 already known, circling our sun up there. But Percival Lowell died in 1916, his theory's still only a theory, till 1930 when Clyde Tombaugh, in a scientific query, discovered Planet X, 3.7 billion miles from our sun. A smallish ball of frozen rock, methane and nitrogen. It joined Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Our solar system's newest neighbor, two-thirds the size of our moon. A tiny, barely visible speck, cold, minus 440 below. Not exactly paradise. They named the planet Pluto. Same year, 1930, Walt Disney debuted his own Pluto as well. But a cartoon dog with the very same name as the CEO of hell was not your normal Disney style. Most figured he was riding the coattails of Pluto mania sweeping the land, not unlike our modern love for dolphins and whales. For the next 5 decades, mysterious Pluto faded our minds. As late as 1978, its own moon Charon was seen for the very first time. But now telescopes and satellites and computer calculations say that Pluto may not be a planet at all, creating great consternation. Some scientists say that Pluto is a trans-Neptunian interloper swept away by an unknown force, or a remnant of a wayward comet somehow sucked off course. Others say that Pluto is an asteroid and the sun's gravitational pull. But if you ask Clyde Tombaugh, he'll tell you that's all bull. I get hundreds of letters from kids every year, he says. It's Pluto, the planet they love. It's not Pluto the comet, it's not Pluto the asteroid they wonder about above. And at the International Astronomical Union Working Group for Planetary System Nomenclature, they too say that Pluto is a planet, reinforcing Clyde Tombaugh's view of nature. Norwegian Carrie Exness, professor at the Theoretical Astrophysics Institute, he too says that Pluto is a planet, and a significant one to boot. But at the University of Colorado, astronomer Larry Esposito says if Pluto were discovered today, it would not be a planet. End of discussion, finito. He says that it was not spun off from solar matter like the other eight planets we know. By every scientific measurement we have, is Pluto a planet? No. And now 20 astronomy textbooks refer to Pluto as less than a planet. I guess if Pluto showed up in a planet convention, the bouncer at the door might have to ban it. St. Christopher is looking down on all this and he says, Pluto, I can relate. When I was demoted from sainthood, I gotta tell you, little buddy, it didn't feel real great. And Scorpios look up in dismay because Pluto rules their sign. Is now reading their daily horoscope just a futile waste of time? It takes 247 Earth years for Pluto to circle our sun. It's tiny and it's cold, but of all heavenly bodies, it's Clyde Tombaugh's favorite one. He's 90 now and works every day in Las Cruces, New Mexico, determined to maintain the planetary status of his beloved Pluto. But how are we going to deal with it if science comes up with the proof that Pluto was never a planet? How do we handle this truth? As the PhDs all disagree, we don't know yet who's wrong or who's right. But wherever you are, whatever you are, Pluto, we know you're out there tonight. And in the year 2003, you're going to see the NASA Pluto Express fly by and take pictures of your way cool surface to send to this webpage address. http://doxxx.colorado.edu/plutohome.html. You've got your own webpage, but little guy, you've made quite a splash. Yes, at the turn of the 20th century, astromathematician Percival Lowell, in his quest for Planet X, started this ball to roll. But at the end of the 20th century, we think he may have been a little off base. So we look at the sky and wonder what new surprises await us in outer space. We look at the sky and we wonder.
Christine Lavin, Ask for Her by Name. Except, no, you can accept substitutes. There are some other wonderful people out there. But she will always be the one for me. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. This program is called Hour of the Wolf. And, of course, we're also webcasting over WBAI.org, but we are not tonight on Facebook Live. Although on my Facebook page tomorrow, you can hear the very same audio that you're hearing now, so you can listen to this show, this very episode, over and over and over again. Is it? Doesn't that do your heart good to know? Alrighty, in keeping with dedicating the program to, I can't move this mic. Okay, is it actually resting on the bar? That's what it is. See, it's supposed to be suspended. Oh, that just turns it upside down so that I can't talk into it at all. I really ought to grab one of the other microphones. You know, a little desk stand mic. But I'm about to do a reading, so I have to get it into the correct position. So, as I was saying, in keeping with themes and subjects and ideas that Stephen Hawking, who was no stranger to reading science fiction, he could talk it quite well with writers and many of the best, and of course made his appearance on any number of science fiction TV shows and the like, did cameos in Star Trek, and I guess it was Stargate Atlantis as opposed to Stargate itself. I thought I would pull out one of the classic time travel short stories by one of the classic writers of science fiction, that being William Tenn, T-E-N-N. Now, William Tenn, again, like Robert Sheckley and some other people, is not a person who today has remained a household name. Among other things, he was probably best known for short stories, which is not a great way to fame. But his short stories were wonderful and had any number of themes. He was a character. He was quite a character. And born 1920, died in 2010, just before he turned 90 years old, about 3 months before. His real name was Philip Klass, K-L-A-S-S. And please, people, do not confuse him with the oofologist by that name, a person who tries to tell us what UFOs are, because that stuff is, well, that's pseudoscience. I mean, there are unidentified flying objects. If you see something flying and you can't identify it, it's a UFO. But they ain't alien, okay? Anyway, neither here nor there. The point is, this Philip Klass wrote under the name William Tenn, and he was a humorist. He was a great satirist. And a nice guy. And one of his best-known short stories in the day was one entitled The Brooklyn Project. The gleaming bowls of light set in the creamy ceiling dulled when the huge circular door at the back of the booth opened. They returned to white brilliance as the chubby man in the severe black jumper swung the door shut behind him and dogged it down again. 12 reporters of both sexes exhaled very loudly as he sauntered to the front of the booth and turned his back to the semi-opaque screen stretching across it. Then they all rose in deference to the cheerful custom of standing whenever a security official of the government was in the room. He smiled pleasantly, waved at them, and scratched his nose with a wad of mimeograph papers. His nose was large, and it seemed to give added presence to his person. "Sit down, ladies and gentlemen, do sit down. We have no official folder all in the Brooklyn Project. I am your guide, as you might say, for the duration of this experiment, the acting secretary to the executive assistant on press relations. My name is not important. Please pass these amongst you." They each took one of the mimeograph sheets and passed the rest on. Leaning back in the metal bucket seats, they tried to make themselves comfortable. Their host squinted through the heavy screen and up at the wall clock, which had one slowly revolving hand. He patted his black garment jovially where it was tight around the middle. To business. In a few moments, man's first large-scale excursion into time will begin, not by humans, but with the aid of a photographic and recording device which will bring us incalculably rich data on the past. With this experiment, the Brooklyn Project justifies $10 billion and over 8 years of scientific development. It shows the validity not merely of a new method of investigation, but of a weapon which will make our glorious country even more secure, a weapon which our enemies may justifiably dread. Let me caution you first not to attempt the taking of notes, even if you have been able to smuggle pens and pencils through security. Your stories will be written entirely from memory. You all have a copy of the security code with the latest additions, as well as a pamphlet referring specifically to Brooklyn Project regulations. The sheets you have as a pamphlet referring... The sheets you have just received provide you with the required lead for your story. They also contain suggestions as to treatment and coloring. Beyond that, so long as you stay within the framework of the documents mentioned, you are entirely free to write your stories in your own variously original ways. The press, ladies and gentlemen, must remain untouched and uncontaminated by government control. Now, any questions? The 12 reporters looked at the floor. 5 of them began reading from their sheets. The paper rustled noisily. What? No questions? Surely there must be more interest than this in a project which has broken the last possible frontier, the fourth dimension time. Come now, you are the representatives of the nation's curiosity. You must have questions. Bradley, you look doubtful. What's bothering you? I assure you, Bradley, that I don't bite. They all laughed and grinned at each other. Bradley half rose and pointed at the screen. Why does it have to be so thick? I'm not the slightest bit interested in finding out how Kronar works, but we can all see from here. But all we can see from here is a grayed and blurry picture of men dragging apparatus around on the floor. And why does the clock only have one hand? Ah, a good question, the acting secretary said. His large nose seemed to glow. A very good question. First, the clock has but one hand because, after all, Bradley, this is an experiment in time, and security feels that the time of the experiment itself may, through some unfortunate combination of information leakage and foreign correlation, in short, a clue might be needlessly exposed. It is sufficient to know that when the hand points to the red dot, the experiment will begin. The screen is translucent and the scene below somewhat blurry for the same reason. Camouflage of detail and adjustment. I am empowered to inform you that the details of the apparatus are, significant. Any other questions? Culpepper of Consolidated, isn't it? Yes, sir. Consolidated News Service. Our readers are very curious about that incident of the Federation of Kronar Scientists. Of course, they have no respect or pity for them, the way they acted at all. But just what did they mean by saying that this experiment was dangerous because of insufficient data? Oh, and that fellow, Dr. Chasen, their president. Do you know if he'll be shot? The man in black pulled at his nose and paraded before them thoughtfully. I must confess that I find the views of the Federation of Kronar Scientists, or the Federation of Chronic Sires, as we at Pike's Peak prefer to call them, are a trifle too exotic for my tastes. I rarely bother with weighing the opinions of a traitor in any case. Chasen himself may or may not have incurred the death penalty for revealing the nature of the work with which he was entrusted. On the other hand, he, may not or may have. That is all I can say about him for reasons of security. Reasons of security. At the mention of the dread phrase, every reporter straightened against the hard back of his chair. Culpepper's face lost its pinkness in favor of a glossy white. They can't consider the part about Chase in a leading question, he thought. But I shouldn't have cracked about the damned Federation. Culpepper lowered his eyes and tried to look ashamed of the various idiots as he possibly could. He hoped the acting secretary to the executive assistant on press relations would notice his horror. The clock began ticking very loudly. Its hand was now only 1/4 of an arc from the red dot at the top. Down on the floor of the immense laboratory, activity had stopped. All of the seemingly tiny men were clustered around two great spheres of shining metal resting against each other. Most of them were watching dials and switchboards intently. A few, their tasks completed, chatted with a circle of black-jumpered security guards. "We are almost ready to begin Operation Periscope. Operation Periscope, of course, because we are, in a sense, extending a periscope into the past. A periscope which will take pictures and record events of various periods ranging from 15,000 years to 4 billion years ago. We felt that in the view of the various critical circumstances attending this experiment, international scientific, a more fitting title would be Operation Crossroads. Unfortunately, that title has been preempted. Everyone tried to look as innocent of the nature of that other experiment as years of staring at locked library shelves would permit. No matter. I will now give you a brief background in Kronar practice as cleared by Brooklyn Project Security. Yes, Bradley? Bradley again got partly out of his seat. I was wondering, we know there's been a Manhattan Project, a Long Island Project, a Westchester Project, and now a Brooklyn Project. Has there ever been a Bronx Project? Yeah, I come from the Bronx. Civic pride. Yes, quite. Very understandable. However, if there is a Bronx Project, you may be assured that until its work has been successfully completed, the only individuals outside of it who will know of its existence are the President and Secretary of Security. If I say there is such an institution, the world will learn of it with the same shattering suddenness that it learned of the Westchester Project. I don't think that the world will soon forget that one. He chuckled in recollection, and Culpepper echoed him a bit louder than the rest. The clock's hand was close to the red mark. Yes, yes, the Westchester Project, and now this, our nation shall yet be secure. Do you realize what a magnificent weapon Kronar places in our democratic hands to examine only one aspect? Consider what happened to the Coney Island and Flatbush sub-projects. The events are mentioned in those sheets you received before the uses of Kronar were fully appreciated. It was not yet known in those first experiments that Newton's third law of motion, action equaling reaction, held for time as well as it did for the other three dimensions of space. When the first Kronar was excited backward into time for a length of 1/9 of a second, the entire laboratory was propelled into the future for a like period and returned in unrecognizable condition. That fact, by the way, has prevented excursions into the future. The equipment seems to suffer amazing alterations, and no human could survive them. But do you realize what we could do to an enemy by virtue of that property alone? Sending an adequate mass of Kronar into the past while it is adjacent to a hostile nation would force that nation into the future, all of it simultaneously, a future from which it will return populated only with corpses. He glanced down, placed his hands behind his back, and teared on his heels. That is why you see two spheres on the floor. Only one of them, the ball on the right, is equipped with Kronar. The other is a dummy, matching the other's mass perfectly and serving as counterbalance. When the Kronar is excited, it will plunge 4 billion years into our past and take photographs of an Earth that was still a half-liquid, partly gaseous mass solidifying rapidly in a somewhat inchoate solar system. At the same time, the dummy will be propelled 4 billion years into the future, from whence it will return much changed, but for reasons we don't completely understand. They will strike each other at what is to us now and bounce off again to approximately half the chronological distance of the first trip, where our Kronar apparatus will record data of an almost solid planet plagued by earthquakes and possibly holding forms of sublife in the manner of certain complex molecules. After each collision, the Kronar will return roughly half the number of years covered before, automatically gathering information each time. The geological and historical periods we expected to touch are listed from 1 to 25 in your sheets. There will be more than 25, naturally, before both balls come to rest, but scientists feel that all periods after that number will be touched for such a short while as to be unproductive. Remember, at the end, the balls will be doing little more than throbbing in place before coming to rest, so that even though they still ricochet centuries on either side of the present, it will be almost unnoticeable. Ah, a question I see? The thin woman in gray tweeds beside Culpepper got to her feet. I know this is irrelevant, she began, but I haven't been able to introduce my question into the discussion at any pertinent moment. Mr. Secretary, Acting Secretary, the chubby little man in the black suit told her genially, I'm only the Acting Secretary. Go on. Well, I want to say, Mr. Secretary, is there any way at all that our post-experimental examination time may be reduced? 2 years is a very long time to spend inside Pike's Peak, simply out of fear that one of us may have seen enough and be unpatriotic enough to be dangerous to the nation. Once our stories have passed the censors, it seems to me that we could be allowed to return to our homes after a safety period of, let's say, 3 months. I have 2 more children. There are others here.
Speak for yourself, Mrs. Bryant, the man from security roared.
It is Mrs. Bryant, isn't it? Mrs. Bryant of the Women's Magazine Syndicate, Mrs. Alexis Bryant. He seemed to be making minute pencil notes across his brain. Mrs. Bryant sat down beside Culpepper again, clutching her copy of the amended security code, the special pamphlet on the Brooklyn Project, and the thin mimeograph sheet of paper very close to her breast. Culpepper moved hard against the opposite arm of his chair. Why did everything have to happen to him? Then, to make matters worse, this crazy woman looked cheerfully at him as if expecting sympathy. Culpepper stared across the booth and crossed his legs. You must remain within the jurisdiction of the Brooklyn Project, because that is the only way that security can be certain that no important information leakage will occur before the apparatus has changed beyond your present recognition of it. You didn't have to come, Mrs. Bryant. You volunteered. You all volunteered. After your editors had designated you as their choices for covering this experiment, you all had the perfectly democratic privilege of refusing. None of you did. You recognize that to refuse this unusual honor would have shown you incapable of thinking in terms of national security, would have, in fact, implied a criticism of the security code itself from the standpoint of the unusual 2-year examination time. And now this. For someone who had hitherto been thought of as able and trustworthy as yourself, Mrs. Bryant, to emerge at this late hour with such a request makes me, the little man's voice dropped into a whisper, it almost makes me doubt the effectiveness of our security screening methods. Culpepper nodded angry affirmation at Mrs. Bryant, who was biting her lips and trying to show a tremendous interest in the activities of the laboratory floor. The question was irrelevant, highly irrelevant. It took up time which I had intended to devote to a more detailed discussion of the popular aspects of Cronar and its possible uses in industry, but Mrs. Bryant must have her little feminine outburst. It makes no difference to Mrs. Bryant that our nation is daily surrounded by more and more hostility, more and more danger. These things matter not in the slightest to Mrs. Bryant. All she is concerned with are the 2 years of her life that her country asks her to surrender so that the future of her own children may be more secure. The acting secretary smoothed his black jumper and became calmer. Tension in the booth decreased. Activation will occur at any moment now, so I will briefly touch upon those most interesting periods which the Cronar will record for us and from which we expect the most useful data. 1 and 2, of course, since they are the periods at which the Earth was forming into its present shape. Then 3, the Precambrian period of the Protozoic, 1 billion years ago, the first era in which we find distinct records of life, crustaceans and algae for the most part. 6, 125 million years in the past covers the Middle Jurassic, the Mesozoic. This excursion into the so-called Age of Reptiles may well provide us with photographs of dinosaurs and solve the old riddle of their coloring, as well as photographs, if we are fortunate, of the first appearance of mammals and birds. Finally, 8 and 9, the Oligocene and Miocene epochs of the Tertiary period mark the emergence of man's earliest ancestors. Unfortunately, the Cronar will be oscillating back and forth so rapidly by that time that the chance of any decent recording, a gong sounded. The hand of the clock touched the red mark. 5 of the technicians below pulled switches, and before the journalist could lean forward, the 2 spheres were no longer visible through the heavy plastic screen. Their places were empty. The Cronar has begun its journey to 4 billion years in the past, ladies and gentlemen, an historic moment, a profoundly historic moment. It will not return for a little while. I shall use the time in pointing up and exposing the fallacies of the Federation of Chronic Sires. Nervous laughter rippled at the acting secretary to the executive assistant on press relations. The 12 journalists settled down to hearing the ridiculous ideas torn apart. As you know, one of the fears entertained about travel to the past was the most innocent-seeming facts which would cause cataclysmic changes in the present. You are probably familiar with the fantasy in its most popular form. If Hitler had been killed in 1930, he would not have forced scientists in Germany and later occupied countries to emigrate. This nation might not have had the atomic bomb. Therefore, no third atomic war, and Venezuela would still be a part of the South American continent. The traitorous Chasen and his illegal federation extended this hypothesis to include much more detailed and minor acts, such as shifting a molecule of hydrogen that in our past was never shifted. At the time of the first experiment of the Coney Island sub-project, when the Cronar was sent back for 1/9 of a second, 12 different laboratories checked through every device imaginable, searched carefully for any conceivable damage. There were none. Government officials concluded that the time stream was a rigid affair, past, present, and future, and nothing in it could be altered. But Chasen and his cohorts were not satisfied. They won. 4 billion years ago, the Cronar floated in a cloudlet of silicon dioxide above the boiling earth and languidly collected its data with automatically operating instruments. The vapor it had displaced condensed and fell in great shining drops. Insisted that we should do no further experimenting until we had checked the mathematical aspects of the problem yet again. They went so far as to say that it was possible if the changes occurred, we would not notice them, that no instruments imaginable could detect them. They claimed that we would accept these changes as things that had always existed. Well, this at a time when our country and theirs, ladies and gentlemen of the press, theirs too, was in greater danger than ever. Words failed him. He walked up and down the booth, shaking his head. All the reporters on the long wooden bench shook their heads with him in sympathy. There was another gong. The two dull spheres appeared briefly, clanged against each other, and ricocheted off into opposite chronological directions. "There you are." The government official waved his arms at the transparent laboratory floor above them. "The first oscillation has been completed. Has anything changed? Isn't everything the same?" "But the dissidents would maintain that alterations have occurred, and we haven't noticed them. With such faith-based, unscientific viewpoints, there can be no argument. People like these two." 2 billion years ago, the great ball clicked its photographs of the firing, erupting ground below. Some red-hot crust rattled off its sides. 5 or 6,000 complex molecules lost their basic structure as they impinged against it. 100 did not.
"We'll labor 30 hours a day out of 33 to convince you that black isn't white, that we have 7 moons instead of 2. They are especially dangerous."
A long, muted note as the apparatus collided with itself. The warm orange of the corner lights brightened as it started out again.
"Because of their leaning, because of their learning, because they sought for guidance in better ways of vegetation."
The government official was slithering up and down rapidly now, gesturing with all of his pseudopods.
"We are faced with a very difficult problem. At present..."
3.1 billion years ago. The primitive triple trilobite the machine had destroyed when it materialized began dripping down wetly.
"A very different problem, a very difficult problem. The question before us, should we schlick or shouldn't we schlick?"
He was hardly speaking English now. In fact, for some time, he hadn't been speaking at all. He had been stating his thoughts by slapping one pseudopod against the other, as he always had. 4.5 billion years ago, many kinds of bacteria died as the water temperature changed slightly.
"This, then, is no time for half measures. If we can reproduce well enough..."
5.25 million years ago. 6.125 million years ago.
"To satisfy the 5 who spiral, we have..."
7.62 million years ago. 8.31 million. 9.15 million. 10.75 million.
"Spared all attainable virtue, then."
11.12. 13. 14. 15. 16. 17. 18. 19.
Bong, 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 bong. "And we are indeed ready for refraction, and that, I tell you, is good enough for those who billow and those who snap. But those who billow will be proven wrong, as always, for in the snapping is the rolling, and the rolling is only truth. There need be no change merely because of a sodden psyllium. The apparatus has rested at last in the fractional conveyance. Shall we all view it subtly?" They all agreed, and their bloated, purpled bodies dissolved into liquid and flowed up and around the apparatus. When they reached its 4 square blocks, now no longer shrilling mechanically, they rose, solidified, and regained their slime-washed forms. "See," cried the thing that had been the acting secretary to the executive assistant on press relations, "see, no matter how subtly... those who billow were wrong. We haven't changed. He extended 15 purple blots triumphantly. Nothing has changed. The Brooklyn Project by William Tenn. Do I have to tell you this is the Chamber Brothers?
brown, and the sky is a hazy shade of winter. Hear the Salvation Army band. Down by the riverside, it's bound to be a better ride than what you got planned. Carry your cup in your hand and look around you. He's a brown now, and the sky is a hazy shade of winter. Hang on to your hopes, my friend. That's an easy thing to say, but if your hopes should pass away, simply pretend that you can build them again. Look around, the grass is high, the fields are ripe, it's the springtime of my. Stop and rebel for me at any convenient time. Find out my memberships while the noble manuscripts of unpublished rhyme. Drinking my vodka and lime, I look around, leaves are brown now, and the sky is a hazy shade.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, webcasting over WBAI.org, and vibrating in many different ways. The short story you just heard is Brooklyn Project by William Tenn, published in 1948. Okay, that's really important to bear in mind. It was actually written in 47, published in 48. The very first story I see, looking at some ancillary materials here, the very first story bought by the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, a.k.a. FNSF. And he was William Tenn, a.k.a. Philip Klass. His real name is Philip Klass. Again, I have to stress this every time, not to be confused with the oofologist. William Tenn wrote this story at a very, very ripe time. We're in a ripe time today. And don't think that 1947, just post-World War II, wasn't equally so. It's, you know, a year after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We are beginning the Cold War. There was a place, he has in an afternote here, supermarkets that stock Polish hams, Poland, after all, being behind the Iron Curtain and a full-fledged communist state, were picketed as being of doubtful patriotism. The Joseph McCarthy is gaining power. HUAC, the House of Un-American Activities Committee, is all over the place. The original Rat Pack with Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart and their associates were formed in order to counter what HUAC was doing in supporting people who were not going to testify. One junior congressman had proposed that there be a seat in the cabinet for security. In essence, today, that has happened, hasn't it? Security was the watchword of the day, and everybody had been talking about the manufacturing secrets of the atomic bomb, details of which were not fully known. So this story, 1947, it was just made for satire. It was just the
And the very people, the Federation of Atomic Scientists, these were the younger physicists and chemists who had worked on the Manhattan Project, were terrified of what they had done, and they were under attack from, they were being called unpatriotic. The government, much of it, was trying to undermine the people themselves. So bear that in mind when you think of the provenance of that wonderful, wonderful story. There's another one by William Tenn that is probably one of my very favorite stories ever on freedom of speech. In his way, he liked to write a great deal about the Bill of Rights. I don't know if he would have seen it that way, and I wish I had had the opportunity to put the question to him. He lived in Midwestern Pennsylvania, and at the time that I finally had a connection to meet him in an opportunity, and I talked with him a couple of times on the phone, I didn't drive at the time. It was not easy for me to get out to where he was, and he had retired of from the University of Pennsylvania. So, alas, that interview never happened. So, what can I tell you? Nevertheless, he remains one of my favorite writers. There was a thing about writers from the late 40s through the mid-50s in the Digest era. People like Robert Sheckley, Richard Matheson, not so many women. In that time, science fiction had still really not advanced progressively in any way, shape, or form. There were a number of great women science fiction writers, many of whom reveled in using two initials for their first name. Not C.M. Kornbluth, that was Cyril M. Kornbluth. But it was common enough. Or C.L. Moore, Catherine Moore. And even when she collaborated with her husband, Henry Kuttner, the two of them writing together were known as Lewis Paget. And then it is charged, but I don't buy it for a second, that Lee Brackett, the great writer, author aside from a lot of wonderful, brilliant pulp science fiction that continues to be mined for pulp fiction today. And I gotta say, somebody has got to take the old Lee Brackett novels, An Enchantress of Venus or something like that, and turn those into movies. And after all, she gave us so much in the way of movies. She wrote the screenplay for The Big Sleep, starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. Yes, I know you're going to say, wait a minute. My brain is mush at this point. Whose name was on? Jesus, now, you know, my brain is mush. One of the great writers was, type in The Big Sleep screenplay, was credited first and foremost in big letters for the screenplay. But there are rumors, there are stories about, yes, William Faulkner, of course, William Faulkner. William Faulkner got the primary credit, and then after that, Lee Brackett collaborating with Jules Furthman. And the two of them collaborated a few times on different movies directed by Howard Hawks. Faulkner, the rumor goes, was basically, shall we say, in his cups while the movie was being written. And the rumor goes that Furthman was coming up with the ideas. Brackett was actually writing the screenplay, and every so often they would pull William Faulkner's head out of his soup and say, "What do you think of this, Bill?" And you go, "Vang," and they put it back down, and that's how The Big Sleep got written. Oh, not good enough? Okay, how's about a movie called The Empire Strikes Back? Lee Brackett wrote that one. Sadly, she died before that movie was done, at quite an advanced age, and the screenplay was completed
by Lawrence Kasdan, who did a darned good job on it. But it was Lee Brackett's story and basic screenplay. But she also wrote Hatari. She wrote films for John Ford. Let me see if I can get a brief thing. I ought to do a bunch of shows for Lee Brackett this year, because we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of modern science fiction, and it all began with a woman by the name of Mary Shelley. Let's see, Rio Bravo, that's a great one. The Long Goodbye, another Philip Marlowe movie, only this one starring Elliot Gould and directed by Robert Altman. Now imagine somebody who could write for Howard Hawks, John Ford, and Robert Altman and George Lucas, okay? She was amazing. And she wrote hard-boiled mysteries as well. But and many people say, in fact, I first heard this from WBAI staffer Robert J. Barish, that Edmund Hamilton, a.k.a. Mr. Lee Brackett, wrote a book called The Star Kings. And if one were to read that, one would find a lot of where Star Wars came from, which is what brought George Lucas to hire Lee Brackett. I believe Edmund Hamilton by that time was already dead. But such books as Long Tomorrow, a mainstay of Planet Stories, Startling Stories, Thrilling Wonder Stories. How did I get into talking all about Lee Brackett? Can't say offhand, but do check out her writing and her movies. You won't be sorry. Very, very rich, just totally entertaining material. Okay, were there flubs during that reading? Oh my God, I can't begin to tell you how many. Since I have become an editor of audiobooks, meaning audio editor, and of course podcasts, I do hope that you listen to me every week on the Lightspeed Magazine Story Podcast, available at lightspeedmagazine.com, or actually at any place where podcasts are available. I won't say sold, because it is in fact free. And I also do the audio editing for Nightmare Magazine from the same editor, John Joseph Adams. I have become acutely aware, working with some of the best voice people in the industry, voice actors around, like Stefan Rudnicki and Gabrielle DeCure and his son Alex Hyde-White, and so on and so forth. So when I make a flub, I am well aware of it, but a big, big difference between that, I hear their flubs. That's my job, get rid of their flubs. I was reading that live. That's the thing about freeform live radio. You're walking upon a razor blade. I'm quoting Bob Fass here. Nothing that Fass ever said on the air, at least not that I'm aware of. He and I were once having a conversation about the nature of freeform live radio, and he described it that way. And at the time, I thought, there goes Fass. And now that I have a few more years under my belt, as he certainly had, and the incredible experience and knowledge that he has about it, he's so absolutely right. Now, does that mean that you can fall down, because of the sharp edge of it? Yes, maybe so. Maybe there were flubs, but I still enjoy and entertain the prospect of doing freeform radio with live readings, which is what that was. In 2 weeks, you're going to hear some recorded readings, specifically from the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. Last week's, in fact, we will have Elisa Quitney, a.k.a. Elisa Sheckley, because as daughter of Robert Sheckley, she occasionally adopts her father's last name. She mostly uses her mother's last name in writing. And, well, that fits into everything we were talking about. And she is a brilliant, wonderful writer and editor of comics and writer of comics on her own. Her latest novel is Citadel and Corpse. And also, Nicholas Kaufman, who also read for us last week. And I have to just edit those down so that the pauses and flubs and things like that are taken out. And that will be our show in 2 weeks. Next week on this program, we're going to hear a convention, Moments from a science fiction convention held in Westchester this past weekend, where I had a ton of fun. Heliosphere, only in its second year. Lunacon, alas, which has been the New York science fiction convention for several score of years, has imploded for the time being and for the foreseeable future. But Heliosphere has done a fine, fine job. All they need now is an audience to attend, and it'll be complete. But I got to do two interviews. Good God, Lister, how the bleep have you been, and why are you already wearing shorts? And I don't have my Facebook Live going, so I'm afraid the shorts are wasted on our listening audience. But you can imagine. I haven't seen you in like 5 or 6 weeks.
Yeah, I got the flu from WBAI, and I got sick, and it was horrible.
And that was after I had had the flu. Hopefully, exactly. You did not get it from me, because I stayed away for more than a month.
I did what you did.
You did what I did.
Yeah, and then I just went to Fort Myers Beach to go running, and I'm just coming
back. Yeah, and, oh, okay, very good. So you took a long recuperative period. I'm very, very, very pleased to hear that. Thank you so much.
Thanks. It's good to see you.
Likewise. And it was so great seeing Hob Day 1 week, and Ken Gale did a lovely job, I thought,
yes,
last week. But so glad to have you back. So let's see, where was I? I was blathering on about, I forgot my tripod, so I don't have anything to hold.
I'll hold it.
No, well, for me to set up the Facebook Live, I have to do so much stuff. I'd have to sit here muttering into the phone for about 5 minutes. So it's basically, when I get here, 12:30 is when I have to start setting it up. And then being distracted by saying hi to people and things like that, it takes me a lot of that time to set it up. Also, since I have what they call two-step authentication, if I set something up on the computer, it gets my phone has to say, oh, yeah, it's okay to do that. And the moment that my phone gets interrupted, then that destroys the Facebook Live. So you see, I can't do it in the midst of anything. But nevertheless, I'm getting somebody tweeting or saying, Lister is back! and that's somebody, I kid you absolutely not, from Bulgaria.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay. So he's very, very happy that Lister is back. As am I. So,
by the way, my sister says she's...
If you're going to talk at any, you know, for more than a word or two, get near a microphone.
Oh, by the way, my sister, Caroline Huenlo, is a big fan of your show.
Is she really?
And she constantly sings your intro and outro.
Oh, really? Well, there's no singing to my intro.
I know, but she's humming it. And
it's a very hummable.
And the sales tune.
Sales of Silver.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful number.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
really is.
But you look healthy, though. Seriously, you're rested.
I'm doing okay.
Your complexion is nice.
Yeah, well, not really, actually. Yeah. That's a whole other story.
Okay. Right.
But, yeah, but I'm doing okay. I'm doing well.
Hello, Bulgaria.
Hello, Bulgaria. Indeed. So, let's see. What was I saying?
I don't know. It doesn't matter that much. If you would like to call up and discuss the topics of the morning, which include, shall we continue with Facebook Live? How shall we continue with that? The work of Stephen Hawking, my crackpot business over the Big Bang, not being solid, absolute solid science, and the work of William Tenn and the life of Kate Wilhelm, or the art of Kate Wilhelm, then you can give us a ring at area code 347-335-0818. Again, 347-335-0818. Oh, I know what I was talking about before. I was saying next week on the show, I'd been at Heliosphere, and there were two guests of honor, there were four really, but the two main writers' guests of honors, I got to do official interviews with each of them, and one was Chuck Gannon, and the other one was Eric Flint, and both of them were absolutely fascinating, and I know that both went well, because although we had like an hour and 15 minutes, we ran short in things to talk about, especially with Eric Flint. We got and Chuck. In both cases, we got a third of the way through their bios. These are more... Hildy Silverman did an interview with Chuck on Friday, and that got into the nature of his writing and the content of his writing. But I went into the more biographical stuff. What were you reading when you were young? Where did you school? Things like that. And both of them are fascinating. And Eric Flint, quite a background. I would say politically somewhat to the left of many of the people at WBAI, and that's saying a lot, people. Only he's really committed to it. He doesn't follow that because he feels that's the way, because other people of his ilk are that way. He was union promoting and stuff in the 1950s in Alabama, okay? Now that takes a certain kind of hospital insurance, let me tell you. and yes, he talks about that in the interview. So that will be next week on the program. And, okay, good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I didn't notice any flubs in your reading, but then I was hanging on every word you said.
Well, if you're hanging on every word, then you may or may not have noticed sentences that were retaken. So
I haven't.
So there were many flubs. Anything directly affecting the content of the show?
What do you mean, directly affecting the content of the show?
In other words, what about the story? What about Kate?
I haven't heard that story. I can't remember how many years ago.
Okay, relevant. Let's discuss the story, or let's move on.
Okay, you mentioned Heliosphere. My two favorite panels for the weekend happen to be the one on Sherlock Holmes through the ages.
Okay. You know that about three people listening have any idea what you're referring to.
Oh.
That's why I sometimes move you along, Robert.
Well,
it's because it's not just a chat between two people. It's radio.
Well, okay. All right, then I'm looking forward to your...
Look at the big picture. When we're talking about the life of Kate Wilhelm or Stephen Hawking and all that, there are bigger things than saying, I like that panel on Saturday at Heliosphere.
Okay.
The ones that I talked about were relevant because we're going to broadcast them, and I'm the one who did them.
Well, then I will close by saying one of my favorite books is A Brief History of Time.
There you go. Take care. Have a good morning. Okay. And I enjoyed that book a great deal, but as I said earlier, and I wonder if anybody was really paying attention to that, I committed a scientific heresy. I questioned the provenance, the science, the true science behind the Big Bang
theory.
Are you talking about the brief history of time?
Well, in relevance to that, because Hawking's writing is probably the best explanation that we have of understanding the whole thing. But as I was saying earlier, when I forget exactly who was formulating, I have to reread the book, the theory of how the universe began with an incredible, amazing explosion. At least one cosmologist, scientist, who was totally derisive of this said, "What, are you going to try to tell me that the universe was formed by some kind of a big bang?" And that's exactly the tone in which he said it. It's a gag. This is a scientist saying, "I don't buy this for a minute." And he remained to be relevant for many, many years, although he finally came under attack at, I think, Cambridge University, because as more and more people liked the Big Bang theory, then the theory, which is the solid state universe, which is that everything is more or less, it can be moving apart, but that there is no end of time, that there is no beginning of time, that it didn't just form out of a bang, that there are reasons to explain entropy, the fact that things are moving apart from each other, that and many, many things that the Big Bang theory does not explain to this very day. Now, the answer to that is, give it time, no pun intended, we will learn more about it. Well, that I've no doubt of that. But the fact is as we learn more, as science becomes better, as we reach out further beyond our solar system, as we have barely begun to do with Voyager and various things, we learn more, and our theories, our concepts, totally change. As I was saying earlier, 20, 25 years ago, we knew that the dinosaurs died because of volcanic explosions. No question about it. Now we know that they died because of a meteor. No question about it. And in 20 years, there'll be something else. No question about it. And that's all that I'm saying, is that there is wiggle room. And I do read papers, and I do read Scientific American that, and other scientists, credible people that say there is wiggle room, or things simply that are not explained. And we're going to learn about them. And as we do,
but that's what science is about.
That's exactly what science is about. And it does not have finite answers. And the Big Bang Theory is not a finite answer. It is not there is no mathematical proof of it. None. There is observational stuff, and there are still things that Einstein came up with and noticed, and Max Planck, for that matter, in quantum physics, that are not explained by the Big Bang, as it is derisively called. And I wish people would remember that they're saying, of course the Big Bang is hard science. The very term is a put-down of that theory. So all I'm saying is, you know, Fred Hoyle and the other people who didn't buy that, and these are not flat earthers or truthers or anything like that. These are good scientists. They should be listened to, and perhaps, and you can't discard them. You can say, well, let's put that off to the side because there's so much more evidence for this. But evidence is weak, and very, very often it is retrofit in order to meet what we know. And good morning, you're on the radio.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning,
thank
Bob.
Thank you for a good show.
Turn down your radio. This is our caller from Bulgaria, Lister. Lister says hi.
So, hi, Lister. I have a question. Did you say that the story you read by William Tan was first published in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction.
Yes, according to Ten's notes, the afterword that he wrote for that story, it was the very first story sold to FNSF.
Because I was looking through ISF debut while you were reading it, and it appeared in the third volume of Planet Stories in 1948, which was a year before FNSF started.
Well, let me read this more carefully then. Maybe I'm wrong.
Oh.
1947 is the year of the first great science fiction boom, and many successful science fiction anthologies. The editor of one of these, Groff Conklin, was approached by moneyed people who offered to back him and Ted Sturgeon a new magazine of which they were to be co-editors. This is a couple of years before Tony Boucher and J. Francis McComas were to get together to produce the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. Okay, so he was saying that this is a forerunner. And because I was looking at this briefly while I was reading, it said that so this was a harbinger.
It appeared in Planet Stories.
He does not actually say. He just says that it was...
In 1948. Well, I dug up a copy at archive.org and it seems to be there.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Yes, it is available online through several, more than one source, because it's a very, very collected story, and sadly in the public domain at this time. But yes, but it was bought by Ted Sturgeon and Groff Conklin, and had I seen that at all, I would have known it wasn't FNSF, because FNSF, of course,
it's not Anthony Boucher.
Was Tony Boucher, music director at one time of WBAI. So, there you go.
Thank you very much for a great show this morning.
Thank you.
And have a great day.
You too. Take good care.
Thank you.
Okay. So, let's see. Where are we? 2:54. So, we have like 2.5, 3 minutes left. I have, for the most part, spoken my piece this morning. But I also don't have time to put on another piece of music, necessarily, just enough to begin the outro shortly. So I didn't promote the next reading of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, April 3rd. It will be here, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Tuesday, April 3rd, beginning at 7 p.m. with Chandler Klang Smith, who will also be reading this month at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series. We usually try to avoid bumping into each other that way, having the same reader. But it just happened. It just worked out. And that's all right. But so for a slight special added attraction, our other reader on April 3rd will be Chris Claremont. And if anybody out there doesn't know who Chris Claremont is, he wrote X-Men for 19 years. How many movies and TV shows does Chris currently have? Well, Legion, which is, I think, the best expression of Marvel Comics ever to find its way to a small screen, will be beginning its second season shortly. And its first season, I'm just rewatching now, is absolutely, utterly fabulous. But it was Chris who gave soul to Wolverine and Professor X and all these other characters, and backstories to all the rest of them. And there's hardly a comic that Chris hasn't written to. But when I first met him, when I first knew him, Chris was primarily writing prose at that time. I didn't even know, foolish me, that he was responsible for so much in the way of great comic books. But of course now, well, we all know it. So that's it. April 3rd, Chandler Klang Smith, Chris Claremont, a great double feature, if I say so meself. So I hope that you'll come. Admission is free, and we ask for donations, but
Hey, try to donate. If you can't, show up anyway. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper coming your way in just a few minutes with At Long Last Lister. Stay tuned, and I'll be back probably pre-recorded next week. Have a great morning.
Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. other places will hit.
Number one, Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico, talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah. My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I toss you the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
99.5 FM. Lister is back, burning the coolest red, white, and blue to ashes with no apologies. And if it won't burn, guess what? We dip it in acid, as in Bulgaria. Hello, Bulgaria. 99 Sinko, Mr. Live. Yeah. It's good to be back from Fort Myers Beach. Let me tell you something. I was sick. I don't know why I was sick. Picked up the flu from WBAI. But it will kill WBAI before it kills me. Because I'm a rebel. A Maoist with a cause, y'all. Yeah. Not because.
Just because of the cause that they have caused. So many innocent children in the ghetto. Sometimes they don't have a bite to eat. That they have caused you. Rebel with your cause, just because of the cause that they have caused. See, everyone is blaming the other man, and no one really wants to take a stand.
It's time.
from the same bloodline, but we part crisscross and join. And although with one another, we wasn't that familiar. All the same, it was family. That's why me a beg pardon and take this liberty and put down a couple rhyme to your memory. It come in like I just the other day you left school and joined the railway with enough ambition and a future plan. You wasn't drawing big pay, but you was well on your way. And just when you're ready to start, they go choo 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 boogie. Train cut your journey short. Here you get your last send off from your band ground. Before them fly your body down to jam down. The sun stay away from work that day, and the slate gray January day. I sing a silent dirge as dark clouds dart in a different direction, collide and converge, merge and re-emerge in a bluster eye motion in the church grey sky. And the rain it a fall in a squall like tear tip arrows piercing the heart of the moon of them. The Baptist church it full up to the brim, overflow upon the step to the street. Long time no see family and friend, meet and greet, talking about your hasty retreat. Inside mournful voices I sing, them familiar, bittersweet hymn. And it is well, with your soul. Rude boys broke down in tears, miniskirted girls weep and wail. There's a posse of black and white workers from British Rail. Colleague them from your short working years. And there was testimony after testimony from your age mate them, punctuated by spontaneous applause about how you did tall and slim and good looking with your long chin and your captivating grin. About your kindness, about your caring, about your thoughtfulness, about how big and how broad in love. Was. Up to now, we still not get no proper explanation. No witness at the station, no police investigation as to how you come fi hang up on the wrong side of the track. How your face get fit